Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace, FMEP. I am Peter Beinart, non-resident fellow at FMEP. Today is April 16th, 2024, and I'm delighted to be here with Khalil Sayegh, a political analyst focused on Palestinian politics and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Born and raised in the Gaza Strip, Khalil is the co-founder of the Agora Initiative, which promotes constitutional democracies in the Middle East. Khalil, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Peter. Always honored to be with you.
So I know you still have a lot of your family is in Gaza, and I wonder, based on what you hear from them and just what you're observing, how would you describe the situation on the ground now? Has there been any improvement at all since, under apparent pressure from the United States, the Israelis claimed that they were opening more opportunities for food to get into the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, sure. I mean, to start with, when we say Gaza, usually we mean the entire Gaza Strip. And today, since the Israeli reoccupation of the Gaza Strip after October 7th, the reality has been completely different between an area and another. For example, the north of Gaza has been going through an actual famine for the last few months. The south of Gaza, not so much, although it was struggling to access food, etc., but it had certain access to food due to the Rafah crossing, etc. Also, the north has been struggling with an extreme sense of loneliness because Israel have destroyed the entire security apparatus of Hamas in the north that was not able to function anymore. And the social order has completely collapsed in the north, that you see crimes more, you see gangs, you see like looting of shops and looting of houses, etc. In the south, it was quite different than that. So my family happened to be in the north. They're still in the north. And they lived through this entire situation. I remember talking to my family for the last few months, and for more than 5 months, my family didn't have any animal protein. Only last week did my sister, for example, tell me that, oh, we had chicken for the first time. And why they had chicken for the first time? It's because the Israelis, after the killing of the World Central Kitchen, aid workers were put under pressure by the Biden administration to open the borders from the north, to open, and specifically, they opened the Erez crossing borders and they allowed more aid into Gaza. So this produced more food to Gaza. There became more foods available on the market. For the first time since the beginning of the war, one of the bakeries in the north of Gaza was allowed to work. So today, the north of Gaza has one bakery, which is still not enough for the north of Gaza. We're talking more than 300,000 people, and people would have to stand in the lines for this bakery for like 3 hours to get like, you know, few bitas. For the first time, bita is accessible to in the north, but still, it's not.
So for people who don't understand, when you say the north, what towns are you talking about? Because some Americans, I think, will have heard these different towns, but they won't know where in the Gaza Strip they are.
Yeah, this is an excellent question, because even the word the north doesn't really mean anything in terms of like before October 7th, there were no such a thing as the north and the south in this specific. But what they mean by the north, which is what the Israelis actually mean. Sorry, you'll edit this, right? What they mean by the north, usually all the area north of Wadi Gaza. I mean, in the middle of the strip, there is what after Gaza City, between Gaza City and Deir el-Balah, which is another town, there is Wadi Gaza. Anything north of Deir el-Balah is considered north of Gaza today. But that's historically not called north of Gaza. This is historically just called Gaza City. So you have got Gaza City all the way up to Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, Jabalia, these other towns. Now, what I was describing is in specifically Gaza City, which is like, you know, the center of cosmopolitan life in the entire Gaza Strip, and where everything was happening before October 7th. Now everything changed because of the war. But yeah, I'm talking Gaza City, Jabalia, Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia. Each of these places is devastated, but I would say the more you go north, the more the devastation is really hard.
And what percentage of Palestinians in Gaza right now are living in the north versus in Rafah, which is right the very, very south up against the border of Egypt where many, many people have fled, versus, I guess, would Khan Yunus be considered the center, or help me understand that?
Yeah, so Khan Yunis would still be considered the south historically. The center would be Nusayrat and Lubrij refugee camps, as well as Deir el-Balah. These are the centers. But Khan Yunis and Rafah are the south. The majority of Palestinians today are between the south, which is Khan Yunis and Rafah, and specifically Rafah more than Khan Yunis, because we've seen after the invasion of Khan Yunis, people moved to Rafah, although there are some people who are coming back to Khan Yunis. But the truth is, a lot of them are finding nothing to return to. There are quite a bit of people in Deir el-Balah as well, because they found it to be an easier route back to the north. It's not as far, although they're prevented from going back to Gaza City. And at the same time, it was quiet. We didn't see a lot of actions in Deir el-Balah. There were some bombardments and airstrikes here and there, but like no serious invasion have happened in Deir el-Balah yet. In Nusayrat, in the middle of Gaza, also we're seeing increased clashing, and we've seen really horrific images yesterday coming from there. So that's how it looks like. The majority, as I said, in Khan Yunis and Rafah, but we don't really have a like a real number about how much people are still in the north. The Israelis claim that there are only 300,000 that remained in the north. It's still a substantial and high number, out of a million,
2 million
obviously.
in roughly overall, right?
Yeah, it used to be 1.1 in the north, that entire area. Today we're talking 300,000. That's what the Israelis claim. Palestinian estimations say it's above 400,000 who are still in the north.
And these are
It's
people who either never left when Israel went in at the beginning of the war and invaded Gaza City in the north, or they're people who came back after they were forced out, but then they've now returned from the south.
No, these are people who never left.
Right.
Israel did not. They're not allowing anyone to return. I mean, we've seen yesterday hundreds of people marching peacefully from the south trying to go to the north, and they were shot. I mean, about three people, a woman and two of her daughters, were shot with live ammunition by the Israelis on the Rashid Street. Just the street on the sea between the north and the south. So no, they're not allowed. Maybe there are people who, for example, moved from Jabalia, which is in the north, to Gaza City, which is also in the north, and then moved back after the Israelis withdraw from from Gaza City back to Jabalia. We've seen some of these things. I mean, obviously the Israeli army is not in the city operating right now, but for example, yesterday, all of a sudden, for the first time since December, we've seen an Israeli reinvasion of Beit Hanun, which is in the far north, closer to what's so-called the Erez crossing border, and they were surrounding a school. And I am not up to date on what happened since yesterday, but they were surrounding a school that has about 3,000 people who are displaced there.
So why is Israel not allowing people? So Israel's claim is that Israel's claim, right, as I understand, is they went into the north, they cleared out Hamas, much of the population was forced to flee. What is Israel's explanation for why they're not allowing people to return back to their homes now, in those areas from which they were expelled?
Obviously, the Israelis would say it's a security concern. The Israelis would say, well, Hamas will come back. Hamas will re-emerge. Hamas will have gun smuggling, etc. But the truth is, there is no merits for these claims, because you're still control the corridor between the north and the south, and you could literally inspect everyone from the south to the north. So to us, to the Palestinians, we see it as this is a willingful ethnic cleansing of the north. It's a willingful policy to keep the people as much as possible in the south, with the hope that an opportunity will emerge to ethnic cleanse them to Egypt, or to push them to Egypt. That's how I see it, at least myself. And I think there was a credible reports that the Israelis were trying to ethnic cleanse the Palestinians to the Egyptians. And I think the truth is, the Israelis sort of were shocked how much Egypt has opposed to that, and their plan sort of failed because the Egyptians has stood out to it. The second thing, one can see clearly that the Israelis are using the return of the people to the north as a bargaining chip with Hamas for the ceasefire negotiation. I mean, when you look at the ceasefire negotiation, you see things like, well, we'll allow 2,000 people to come a day, or we allow 3,000 people, but they're not allowing to the idea of just unconditional return of all civilians. No, they're saying no to that, and they're saying we want to inspect every single civilian who wants to come back from the south to the north, something that also Hamas is still objecting to because they don't want an Israeli inspection for people coming to the north. So that's how things are.
Do you think that Israel's vision of the future of the Gaza Strip would be that the North would become kind of a no man's land, or even a maybe the place where there would be rebuilding of Israeli settlements? Do you think, I mean, what is do you think that there is a chance that Israel may never allow people to return? I mean, you say there's some now, but that they never may allow the full population return to the north of Gaza?
The truth is, we don't know really what the Israeli vision is. There are competing Israeli visions within the Israeli government. There is no really sense of like who is really driving policy. But if you ask me how I thought of it or how I see it, I do see that the first plan for the Israelis was, as it was clear to me, at least the first few months of the war, that there was a plan to ethnic cleanse the north completely, and even maybe the south after that, because they thought really that the borders would be open with Egypt, people would start leaving, and they thought they are pressuring Egypt. Now they failed with that. And I think when they failed with the idea that they can ethnic cleanse Gaza, they never came up with another plan because they did not expect, I think, that they would fail with it. They just thought that they can get away with it and it will work and the world will not care. And to extend the war, although it's unjust still toward the Palestinian, did some fairness in the sense that it stood up to Israel on that, especially the Arabs. They've taken no tolerance toward that. And I think they failed in that sense. Now, in the north, whether they want to rebuild settlements or not, we know that certain elements with the government want that, and they're working hard on trying to do it. But I personally don't see this still happening, not because of their good will, but because in security level it wouldn't work. I mean, Israel until now did not finish Hamas in the north. I mean, we're seeing like operations and it's shooting attacks on soldiers in the north every day. So if you want to put settlers in the north of Gaza, this would be a welcome news for Hamas and Islamic Jihad and others, because relatively settlers are easier target than Israeli soldiers who are with Merkava, yet still they are able to target them. So for security reasons, I don't see this happening. Now, my fear is that what Netanyahu is trying to do is trying to prolong this war as much as possible, all the way up to November, until assuming the Trump administration come back. And not only Trump administration, but Trump administration with combination of neocons like his friends in the previous government. And then he would give him just the green light to do whatever he wants, and then he can push his people to Egypt. But right now, he cannot do this because he doesn't have the American support. And that's my biggest concern.
You mentioned that Hamas is still doing operations from the north. So, I've heard people say, Israel has destroyed 19 of the 24 Hamas battalions. There are just a few Hamas battalions left in Rafah. They need to go and clean those up. Tell me what your sense is of what the state of Hamas is in Gaza militarily now, in the with this war 6 months in.
Yeah, obviously, when I hear people talk about, oh, Israel destroyed Beltanians or something of this form, you can't help but wonder like what sort of military they're talking about, because Hamas is not really a military, it's their paramilitary, and it's you cannot really quantify your win or your destroying of the enemy by talking about Beltanians or whatever. Yes, to a certain extent, no one can doubt that the Hamas's military capabilities has been hit very hard and that they're way weaker than they used to be before. But in terms of like their ability to fight and to injure or kill Israeli soldiers, it's still there. Now, maybe it's not as organized as before, and I think this was the Israeli focus, is to make them as disorganized as possible, to kill commanders and to kill others so that they're weaker. But they're still, as a decentralized militia group or guerrilla fighters, they're still able to fight against the Israelis, and we've seen more attacks. Now, I don't know about the South and what's happening in details there, but we also seen when even the last day when Israel withdrew from Khan Yunis, saying that they accomplished the mission, a few hours before they withdrew from Khan Yunis, four soldiers at least died, or not died, killed by Hamas's fighters. So I really don't know. I have really a lot of doubts about those claims. My fear is that Israel was successful at destroying everything in Gaza except Hamas's military wing.
And what do you think in the so in the north you don't have you know you've got st a lot of people have been forced out, but you still have, you say, several hundred thousand people there. The government, that the Hamas government, is not really operating. So who is, and I don't think there's a large Israeli troop presence in the north, right? So who's actually running things in the north of Gaza right now?
So as always, Peter, Israel finds way to occupy, but without wanting to pay the price of occupation,
Without wanting
without
to have to
wanting
take
to admit it.
responsibility for governing.
Yeah, exactly. So they would occupy and then, like, withdraw and be in the borders of the civilians area, and they would say, well, it's not us, it's not the government. There is a government. There is another. They do this in the West Bank. They did that even before the Palestinian Authority with the Association of Villages. They're trying to do the same right now. They don't want to take responsibility. But when you say, okay, so who would have to take responsibility in the north? Hamas is being targeted daily, including their government leadership. For example, yesterday they assassinated one of the generals of the civilian police of Beit Hanun, the area in the north. He was in Rafah, but they still assassinated him because they don't want to see police forces in the north operating. Fatah, actually, and this is one of the interesting stories. Five intelligence officer of Fatah tried to help secure the aid from the south to the north, and they were assassinated. Three officers of the Palestinian intelligence of Fatah were assassinated by the Israeli army back in March as well. So anyone who tried to really restore sense of order will be assassinated. Other clans members were also assassinated by Israel for trying to helping with that. But the alternative that Israel was trying to propose is our clans in Gaza who would work with Israel. And there were in particular two clans who were in discussion with Israel.
When you
We've
say
seen
clan, what this means, an extended family? What does a clan mean?
a clan in Gaza, yes, it's an extended family that have lived historically in Gaza, and they've managed over years to accumulate certain social power and also a military power. They tend to have guns. They tend to have a large number of male men, not they tend to have large number of men who are capable of fighting, and they have their guns, etc. And they were working with two particular clans. However, we've seen a very strong rejection by the majority of people in Gaza standing up against these people because they've seen how they spread crimes, they spread loneliness, etc. And they used to do that before the Hamas is ruining Gaza. But not only that, one of these clans, in fact, were connected to ISIS and other jihadist groups. So the idea that you can just work with these people is just insane and does not serve anyone. And I think the Israelis have realized that this plan has failed, and they realize right now that they need to do something else. And until now, they are unwilling to come up with any other plan.
And what is your sense about, we talked about Hamas's military position now. What about their political position in Gaza? To what degree is it strengthened? To what degree is it weakened?
So, to be honest, it's hard to have a sense of what's happening. For example, I looked at the Palestinian Center of Surveys last poll, which was surveyed in March 10th, and we've seen increase in support for Hamas as opposed to like in December. In December, we've seen a drop for the support of Hamas generally, and we've seen some increase as opposed to decrease in the West Bank, which is the opposite of what happened in December. So we see changes happening, and things change all the time. But at the same time, it's hard for me to know how much I can take this seriously or not seriously when there is literally everyone is displaced, everyone is in the open in Gaza, and it's impossible to think that these questions were asked privately in a way that protects people's privacy and that people feel safe. So you see this, and you see that more grievances are producing more support for Hamas, and that's legitimate. I'm sure there are a lot of cases like that, but I also see a lot of videos like of people like blaming Hamas for the disaster that's happening, saying, "Why the hell are you bringing us to war after war, and we're not seeing the results?" We're seeing a lot of people, and that's an increasing thing in Gaza, where all sort of conspiracy theories are emerging that Sinwar is actually a spy for Israel. He was freed from jail to bring this disaster to Gaza. So it's hard to really assess how much support they have. And we know that Hamas is paranoid by that. They're so paranoid that they're been working hard to crack down at any voice like that. And we've seen people getting arrested in Gaza for protesting and being tortured and beaten up and threatened. So it's hard to
But
really
how is
assess the
Hamas in a
situation.
position to arrest people, given the fact that they're under attack from Israel?
So what they would do, they're in civilian clothes and they would just come, kidnap you, tie you up, beat you up, and then leave you. They wouldn't anymore. Like, not only, this is not only used against political dissent, though. They do it against political dissent. But right now, let's say I loot a house, they got me. What they will do, they will just, like, right now, the new method is it's horrific, but at the same time, it's the only way that is maintaining social order. They would just hold the guy, tie him up, beat him up really hard, and then like write on him, on his face, that he's harami, which means like he stole something, and then throw him next to a trash can. That's the kind of like, social order that they're trying to bring. So that's similar to political dissent. They will take them, they will beat them up, and then leave them.
And where do you think the where do things stand, you think, with the idea of a hostage release or prisoner change for hostages, a ceasefire? What do you where how do you see the gap between Israel and Hamas on that now?
I think the gap is very clear. The gap is in two things. The one major issue is complete withdrawal, especially in what's so-called the Netzarim Road, which is what used to be Netzarim, a settlement that existed with 2005, that Israel reoccupied it, which literally separated the north from the south. They wanted to complete withdrawal from that. The second point is that this ceasefire of 6 weeks would lead to full ceasefire with full withdrawal of the Israeli forces. These two points, Israel is not willing to consider whatsoever. And to Hamas, it's not starter for them to do 6 weeks ceasefire release of hostages without having the guarantees for this second step. At least that's how Sinwar is thinking of it. I think in Qatar, there is more flexibility, but as far as Sinwar concerned, that's how he sees it.
So Hamas wants a complete end to the war as part of this hostage release, and they want the full withdrawal of Israeli troops, whereas Israel's willing to accept some kind of pause, maybe of 6 weeks, but they want to maintain but they want to be able to resume the war, and they want to be able to maintain some troop presence in Gaza even during that pause. Is that right?
For sure. They want to maintain presence. They want to inspect every single person who comes back to the north, etc. So in a way, they don't want the return of pre-October 7th order. Hamas wants the return of pre-October 7th order in terms of at least civilian rule, that Hamas will be able to rule again. It's not very clear. I didn't see also like any creative solutions being proposed, such as, okay, are you willing to share power with other people as far as Hamas, etc.? No one proposed that because the Israelis are not interested in that too. They don't want to see the Palestinian Authority or someone. But we've seen proposal, for example, oh, maybe Egyptian forces can come between the south and sorry, between the north and the south and inspect people. But we didn't see any positive response to it from the Israelis or Hamas.
So do you think there is any possibility that in some future in Gaza that there could be some kind of force of Arab soldiers?
Again, only in the condition of a Palestinian state. I don't think the Palestinians would want that, even the Palestinian Authority. I don't think the Arabs would want that. I don't think the residents of Gaza would want that. Unless it comes as they have to come, like basically the way I explain it to people, if the Arabs come as the liberator of Gaza and the liberator of Palestine, they'll be welcomed with roses. If they come as an extension or subcontractor of the occupation, they'll be welcomed with guns and rocks on their heads.
Well, given that there's really no political appetite really in Israel for a Palestinian state at this moment, it doesn't really sound from what you're saying that there's any really plausible or realistic way forward from Gaza from this situation we're in now. Can you foresee, what do you foresee, how do you foresee this playing out over the next, in the coming years. Even if Israel were to have an election and Netanyahu were not to be prime minister, it's extremely unlikely that another Israeli government would seriously support the idea of a Palestinian state. So how do you see this playing out?
I think unless there are extremely harsh international pressure on Arab, I don't think the Arabs are doing enough Arab pressure. I don't see a two-state solution emerging. Yes, I agree with you. Even with someone like Yair Lapid coming to power, although it's unlikely, and he's considered the most left, but he's not really left. He doesn't really believe in Palestinian state. But anyway, let's say assume that Yair Lapid comes to power. You need an extreme pressure, and I really mean it by sanctions and threats to stop the military aid and the Arabs cutting relationship with Israel. Maybe this will generate it. So it wouldn't even be certain, but this maybe might generate thing. Now, the reality that this is very unlikely to happen, at least in the next 2 years, and my fear is that Israel will use the loneliness in Gaza and the continuation of the lack of order, etc., to implement an incremental ethnic cleansing. Let me give you an example. I mean, my family, I'm going to pay for them whatever it takes to get them out right now, and they're about to get out. Every other family that I know that affords to pay the $5,000 fee on the Egyptian border is doing the same. And we're talking about 1,000 people a day are leaving Gaza. So in about a month, between 50, it depends, sometimes 1,000, sometimes 500. So between 15 to 30,000 people a month are leaving Gaza. Imagine when the border is more open and you've got completely devastated situation in Gaza, Peter. There are no schools left. There are no hospitals left. There are no higher education institutions left, and there is no infrastructure. So why would you live in Gaza? Even if the situation get better in terms of war. And again, now we are bargaining with Israel about allowing food and medicine into Gaza. No one is talking about reconstruction. And wait until this has come up. They would be up in arms saying this would be used for tunnels. How can we guarantee that there is security? Although they are creating every condition that will prevent a force that will provide security, but then they'll blame it on us. And that's the unfortunate reality of what I think that next 2 years would look like in Gaza.
And also Israel has talked about increasing the buffer zones, right? So the amount of space available to Palestinians in Gaza will be reduced.
It's already 16% of the Gaza Strip has been confiscated. And these 16%,
You mean
majority of
since
them, I
the war
mean,
or before October 7th?
since the war. Since the war, not before October 7th, for sure. I mean, this entire border that you see and some of these Kibbutzim team are actually in Gaza's territories and the armistic lines that there. But no, after that, they took 16% more, majority of which, by the way, are farmers' lands, etc., that used to produce food for Gaza. And that's a reason why, until now, Gaza does not have substantial fruits. I mean, I'll give you a very personal example. My family and the Christian community in Gaza were going through Lent, where they're not supposed to eat vegetable. Sorry, where they're not supposed to eat any animal product or related to it, but they had no fruits to eat, which is what they're supposed to eat, fruits and vegetables. They've got nothing because of the destruction that happened.
So Khalil, when I talk to American Jews and Israeli Jews, and I listen to the media about this war, this is what I hear very frequently. People say something along the lines of, if Israel does not destroy Hamas, if Yahya Sinwar emerges from his tunnel victorious, that's the end of Israel. It's the Israel's deterrence will be destroyed, and basically, we can never allow that to happen. So I wonder if you what you would say to those people who still believe that winning this war has to happen, because if Israel were to lose the war and Hamas were to reemerge, then that would be a catastrophe that Israel could not accept.
I personally tell people the very unfortunate reality that Israel is ensuring every condition that will ensure another October 7th will happen in the future. I was speaking with my dear friends at the Israel Policy Forum before October 7th happened, and I was very clear in a panel in DC that something very bloody going to happen, and the Biden administration are going to regret their neglection of the Palestinian cause and not really proposing a serious peaceful solution to it. And very unfortunate that 2 weeks after October 7 happened, and some of these people came to me and they said, "Oh, Khalil, how could you have seen it?" I said, "How could we not see it? It was very clear. It was very, very, very much there. I was rather shocked by how passive the Palestinian people has been for a while, as opposed to what happened in October 7th. So if the situation continue in the way it is, and there is no solution, there's no end to the occupation, even if Hamas is eliminated, let's assume that this such a thing is possible. I don't think it's possible. Let's assume such a thing is possible. You will get a new Palestinian movement that will attack you. Maybe there wouldn't be Islamists next time, maybe communists, maybe liberal, maybe people who are completely secular and liberal, maybe even I would go as far as say Christian even. I don't know. Maybe they will come from Lebanon next time, they will come from Jordan, but they will come and they will fight you. It wouldn't go away. The only way to defeat Hamas, but not only defeat Hamas, defeat any future Palestinian radical group that want to use violence, is to ensure and show them that the other path works, that you actually will grant them their rights and their state. But if still, any other group still is there, even after you grant these rights, I guarantee you they would not be substantial. They wouldn't be able to mobilize a 5,000 people even in Gaza or the West Bank. But as things stands today, I think Israel have created the conditions for a new October 7th to emerge.
I gave a speech last week, and and I argued for one equal state where everyone is equal under the law, with no privileges for anyone. And a Palestinian woman came to me, and she said, "I believe in your vision. That's what I want too." But she said, "After what Israel has done now in Gaza, I don't know that we can live together." And I wonder. It was very chilling to me. And I wonder what you think about that, about the possibility that there could ever be re reconciliation and coexistence under conditions of equality, given that this horror that Israel has inflicted on Gaza, I imagine will be remembered for generations.
That's an unfortunate reality. It's not that before, like even this war on Gaza, people were very ready, right? And were very optimistic about it. Because even before, I mean, the kind of horror that Israel imposed through all sort of means, even like for Gazans before even October 7th, cancer patients who had to lose their life while waiting for an Israeli permit, literally waiting and lost their life. How could they envision the others? An entire generation of young kids like my brother, who were born and raised in Gaza, never met an Israeli in their life, except when the Israeli Air Forces bombards Gaza. There's no way to see or humanize the other or think of any coexistence with them. So yes, I think that this has been the situation, and it even more increased right now, and it became more of a zero-sum game that there is no way to do it. But that's again why, Peter, unlike you, I think two-state solution would be the most, reasonable, given those reasons. I don't think it's the most just, unlike liberal Zionists would say that's the most just. I think that's the most unjust, but I say that's the most practical at this point, even if we believe in one-state solution at the end. But that's at least to relieve some of the Palestinian pain, to start rebuilding the trust, to start rebuilding certain level of sovereignty for the Palestinians, to feel their power and their equality before we would throw them into having all of a sudden to make reconciliation and peace and coexistence with the Israelis, something that I think will take really long time. But I never give up on hope. I think even one-state solution is definitely better than not having any solution. I would be for any solution that will end this suffering. I myself, for better or for worse, happen to be more liberal, and thus I feel that I can easily live in a one-state solution that even maybe not a Palestinian or an Israeli. I don't see myself living in Israel, to be honest, but I see myself living in some sort of similar society to the US that will re-emerge there. But I don't think the majority of either side at this point are ready for that.
I wanted to just end by asking you your sense about your, as you said, your family is Christian. Your sense about debates among American Christians. Obviously, white American Christians have generally been the kind of backbone of support for Israel inside the Republican Party. And don't seem to, as far as I can tell, really pay much attention to Palestinian Christians at all. I was very struck, though, by this interview that Tucker Carlson just did with the Bethlehem pastor, Munter Isaac. Now, the way Tucker Carlson framed the conversation, I found pretty typically for Tucker Carlson, pretty odious in the sense that he only talked about Christians as basically he couldn't care less about Muslims as if they could live or die for all he cared. But he still did give a platform to this man, who seems like a very, very decent, humane man, to talk about the reality of what it's like to be a Palestinian Christian, in a way that's very rare to hear, in my experience, in kind of right-wing political media. So I wonder, do you think that there is something changing here?
No, that's an interesting question, and it's happened to be like it hit home for me because I went to Bethlehem Bible College, studied under Munter, and he's became a friend, and I was really glad to see him going on Tucker Carlson show. For so long, the right wing in America has been the, as you said, the backbone of supporting Israel, but not only Israel generally, but a very specific vision of Israel, the most violent vision and the most right wing and racist vision. Because to them, it's about biblical narrative that Israel has to reclaim the entire land. And to them, we're not supposed to be there. We don't exist. And not only Palestinian Christians, but Palestinians in general. But then when they even learn the Palestinian Christian exists and that their churches were actually ethnic cleansed just like the mosques on 48, it's a shocker for them. It sort of changed their equation because all of a sudden it raises a theological question about who God is and whose side at that time. Because if God is God of the his people, and the Christians tend to believe the Christians are people's God, and also the Jews as well, there's all sort of theological thinking there. Then was he on the side of the Jews or was he on the side of Christians? So it challenged the very quote unquote biblical narrative that they believe in. But for so long, we were denied access to the right wing. And I spoke a lot. I spent a lot of my time talking to evangelical Christians, and they were willing to listen to me. Why? Because all the time I was willing to talk about Hamas and how horrible they are. And I always talk about Hamas, you know me. But the time I started talking about Israel, I am not welcomed. I am not trusted. They don't believe in me, etc. For so long. Now, I think what's happening on the right is that things are changing with people like Tucker Carlson and others, but I don't know if they are changing necessarily in the most positive direction we want them to see it, because it's changing due to a sense of isolationism that they want to see from the world, a sense of that they want to restore what's so-called the Christian nation in America, and to them, they start seeing that one of the challenging to restoring the Christian nation is to them what they perceive as the Jewish influence. And for example, before the Tucker Carlson like hosting Munter Isaac, we've seen all this beef between him and another conservative show to another conservative host, Ben Shapiro, who happened to be Jewish and who happened to be very, very pro-Israel, would start frustrating people like Tucker because to them the entire debate on the right now, are you in America first? Or are you an Israel first? And I think this will continue to emerge. And I think what is prompting these people to become more and more even radicalized on how they talk about Israel and about the Jewish people for that sense. And that's the sad part because I would like to see more distinguish between both. But what is radicalizing them more is that Jewish conservatives and even Jewish liberals are telling them, well, you know what? You can't talk about this one thing. You can't talk about Israel. You can't talk about the pro-Israel lobby in the US. You can't talk about the pro-Israel lobby in Washington. And all of a sudden, these people start feeling a certain grievances. And now it's being experienced in the way it is.
No, I think you're making a really important point. It's so crucial to distinguish between Jews, American Jews, or any group of Jews, right? And Israel as a state, just like we would want to distinguish between Chinese Americans and the Chinese government, or between Muslim Americans and the government in Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Hamas or whatever, right? It's important ethically. It's also important as a question of safety, right? Because America does get into foreign conflicts, and there are always these forces in America, going back to Japanese Americans and German Americans, that want to hold people in America responsible because they share a religion or an ethnicity or a nationality. And it's important to fight against that and make that distinction clear. And yet, as you say, There are people, both pro-Israel people and also anti-Semitic people, who want to conflate those two things. If we have a world in which we're going to have more and more conflict in Israel-Palestine, that just becomes more dangerous.
Yeah, that's unfortunate reality. And I always tell people I am doing my like above and beyond. I go above and beyond to try to be as respectful and as loving of my Jewish brothers and sisters here in the US. But at some point, you guys need to help us, I tell them, to really be able to distinguish between
Yes.
you and the state of Israel. Because if I walk to your space and you have an Israeli flag everywhere, I mean, I know that you're not Israeli, but at the same time, it makes me wonder, like how am I gonna tackle that? And if I was able to tackle it myself, how am I gonna convince masses of Palestinians and pro-Palestine people that, listen, these people have nothing to do with Israel, but they will be like, well, look at their institutions. The flag of Israel is everywhere. Why is it my business to distinguish between both of them? It's a really difficult space.
Yes, I entirely agree with you. Khalil, thank you so much for doing this. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure to check out the FMEP website for resources related to this podcast and lots of other rich content related to Palestine and Israel. And please make sure you subscribe to this podcast to stay up to date. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify, and you can also watch video versions of our podcast, including this one on YouTube. And with that, I'm Peter Beinart, signing off until the next episode of FMEP's Occupied Thoughts.